Last time when I've been there, they were training in their winter holidays in the Montreux school on a floor without heating in this room. So outside was like 2 meters of snow, the same temperature than inside. But you know, you don't do judo with socks, so they had no socks. Wow. And I was like freezing and shivering, and I said, how do they do this each day, Kazi? Kazi is the name of the coach, the shepherd. And he said, oh, Sabrina, you know, it's really no problem. We just warm up 10 minutes longer.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of the Judo Edit podcast. This is Melissa Budiato, and today I am honored to have a second opportunity to talk with Sabrina Filsmoser. While, as we all know, the Tokyo 2020 Olympics are on hold for a year, Sabrina has been using the time to help those in smaller, struggling countries to get through this pandemic. We will be talking about that soon.
Before we start, have you ever thought of starting your own judo club? Well, if you are based in New South Wales and starting a judo club is something which has crossed your mind, then listen closely. Judo New South Wales are offering free workshops for all you soon-to-be coaches so that you can get started straight away. And no, I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm actually trying to connect you with financing, free mentoring, and free marketing guidance resources. So, if you've been feeling the itch to inspire a new generation of judoka, click on the link in the description below, and you could be running your own dojo by this time next year.
How are you, Sabrina?
Hello, I'm very well. Thank you for your invitation.
I'm very glad that you are back and so excited to talk to you. Now, at the moment, the Tokyo 2020 Olympics should be happening, and I can see, like, in the background of your frame there, you've got the Tokyo image, the logo set up next to your home gym. So I just wanted to ask you what it's been like at the moment trying to train, trying to keep motivated for the Olympics.
Yeah, I think for every high level athlete, it's not very easy to keep the motivation going, but we have a very strong team, and right now it's possible to do also roundary training. So it keeps me like really motivated to go on to Tokyo. And we have done a lot of gym training, a lot of conditioning. Everybody has a good stamina. Everybody has a good body, not many injuries. So I think we are on a good way.
So can you remember what was it like going to your first Olympic Games?
Yeah, I remember very well because I missed two Olympic Games, which I could have managed to qualify. The first one was Sydney 2000, mm-hmm. where I was in the World Championships in Birmingham 1999. And I was fighting for the seventh place, which would have brought me the direct qualification. So the first seven from the World Championships made it to the Olympic Games. But I lost my fight against the Canadian girl. She threw me Vasari. By then it was a little different with the rules, but I did four yukos and not one Vasari. So after the four yukos, I lost the fight and I lost my qualification. I remember I was invited by my coach who brought me to Sydney, and I could experience the Olympics as a training, a sparring partner. And it was the most amazing time I've ever had. I got so much motivation out of it that I was going for the next one to Athens 2004, where I was number four in the European ranking. The first five would have qualified, but I had like a bad crash on my neck during a Teguruma throw like 6 months before. So I hurt really badly my intervertebral discs, and I couldn't fight the next few tournaments. And after the qualification limit, the date was like end of May, I was not under the first five of the European ranking. I got sixth place with 3 points, not qualification coming into the best five. So this was really bad. So my first Olympic Games happened 2008 in Beijing. I was already 28 years, but I didn't give up. I had so much commitment and dedication to fight till my first games that this one was really, I guess, the one which I thought, and I still think I was in the best form, in the best condition, and I had the very best preparation for it. and I felt really strong. I was not too nervous because of all the years before, all the stories I went through, all the injuries. I was not so nervous. I thought I can get the chance to get an Olympic medal, even maybe gold. I came there as the world number one ranked, in a very confident position, but I had not the best draw. I was like playing against the North Korean girl. She was already 2 times Olympic champion, but she didn't show up the months and years before because North Korea had like not the same schedule as the other IGF athletes. So I didn't fought her before. I didn't know about her, how she feels, I saw videos and I knew she's pretty strong. That's not too difficult to watch on video, but if you don't know somebody, how she moves, how her reactions is, it's really difficult. Nevertheless, I gave everything. I was fighting pretty strong, but she threw me ippon and I lost the first fight, so I was out. First round, first Olympic Games, out.
Wow. Now, actually, I was discussing this North Korean girl recently, and I thought it was really interesting that, you know, she only popped up to the really important competitions. So, yeah, wow, that's tough luck. But then you came back for London. Is that right?
I came back for London 2012, where I was 32 years old. Again, I thought the chance to get an Olympic medal is really high. Because I have a lot of experience, I was not in the same shape than Beijing. I knew I was older, but through my experience, I felt really confident to get it done. The problem at this time was they changed the rules pretty much before. So my best technique was tegoruma, gripping some legs, and it was forbidden. Sure, I had some months before to prepare and to get into it and to delete these techniques out of my mind, out of my body. But as you can imagine, with 32 years, it's not that easy to be precisely at the most important tournament of your life in the highest level where you are not able to make a mistake. And at exactly the wrong moment, against a very strong opponent, I made the mistake and I gripped the leg. So it's not the best. I took 7th place, but I was really not happy with it.
I can see like your determination. You keep coming back. You're still not satisfied. You want those medals. And you talk a lot about atmospheres and how, you know, you really absorb the atmosphere of the fight and of the arena. I think you mentioned that in our previous episode. What was it like, the Olympic Stadium, during the games?
It's difficult to describe because every place and every arena, every city or Olympic Games has their own or had their own special atmosphere. I remember in London, the stadium was pretty small. It was not like huge. Or like if you imagine Paris, Bercy, they have pretty different rules during the Olympic Games. There are not so many spectators inside the hall. It's not like the same situation than in a World Championships. But because of the preparation before, because of the tension, the media, it's totally different. Mm-hmm. You have different mindset and you're committed to go through it. And whatever comes, you go for the medal. For sure, it's difficult to describe because sometimes you think you can only fight if the stadium is full and if the spectators give you the energy. But in such places, like for me, the Olympic Games, there are sometimes only a few people who support you. Maybe the family and some of your friends from the Olympic Committee or the coaches, the physio. All others, they are sitting back at home in front of the TV. So this is really different. But in the whole, I would say Olympic Games is amazing from the beginning. When you come to the village during the opening ceremony, you inhale all this atmosphere with all the other athletes from different sports. and your mind is blown away. The first Olympic Games is really something special, even if you watched it on TV or you spoke with so many different people or your team colleagues. I wouldn't have never ever missed the opening ceremony because I wanted to go there, even if I was fighting 2 or 3 days later. I wanted to enjoy it, and I think I always did the right decision, because in the end, if you lose the first fight, if you are unsatisfied with your result, you have this experience of being in the Olympic Games during the opening ceremony. You see the fire and you see all the other athletes there. And I think this was one of the most impressive things I've ever experienced in my life.
Yeah, wow. And I guess you're right. It's part of the reward almost for being that disciplined and earning your place in that stadium. That's amazing. And so, you know, you're currently chasing the 2020 or 2021 Olympics, and it's been a up and down journey so far. What have you learned in this process? What are the key things that you've learned?
I think I'm always like somehow very focused on the mental thing to go this way, to take the journey, to live each day as a very strong experience. And even now, after so many years, I can enjoy every day, each training session, even if it's so hard and really tough. Sometimes you have some injuries or you have not a good feeling to look forward for many weeks or months. And now it's one more year. It's a long time. There can happen so many things. But I've learned to really think and work from one day to the next, because otherwise you miss this main goal. You just want to show your best ability to your coaches or whatever. But for me, it's more like I've learned it's not about talent, because talent is cheap. You know, everybody from our young stars, they know, if we are strong, we go there and we go to the World Championships and afterwards to the Olympic Games. And I will get, if I train very strong, maybe prize money. They are thinking about so many different things. I've never thought from the beginning about prize money, but my dedication and my progress during this process is so much more worth or has so much more values than I've ever expected. Right now, I'm really living my dream, like walking for the next Olympic Games, if I don't know if it's happening.
And I guess this is a part of a listener question, actually, from one of the listeners, Abigail in Sydney. But now that you've walked through all that and you've sort of come to this realization that, you know, you're living it day by day and you're enjoying, you know, chasing the dream, is there anything you would have changed or anything that you would have told Sabrina, you know, 20 years ago, who's trying to qualify for Sydney based on what you've learned now?
I guess if I would have told my young Sabrina about how difficult it gets, I'm not sure if I would have chosen the same way. I had so many injuries and I had so many painful things, but right now I'm happy about them because I've learned during this process. But I would not tell the young ones, be aware, because you can injure yourself maybe not one time, maybe 10 times. No, it's just like doing it. Get the experience. Some are struggling, some are not struggling, but if you don't take this step forward and do it day by day, you will not have the experience to enjoy it.
You know, it sounds like through the journey and through the painful experiences, you also mentioned that in our previous episode that it took you a couple of years to learn how to fail. So do you remember saying that? Is that something you think about a lot?
Yes, I do. Because I guess in the beginning, when I've been like really young, 16, 17, 18 years, I was not prepared to lose. Mm-hmm. When I lost, I was like devastated. I didn't know how to explain my feelings. I didn't want to speak to my coach, to my parents. I just wanted to stand up the next day and train, just train and forget about the bad experience. But now I can really say it took me years to realize that sometimes failure is much more full of values somehow, because you learn so much more. You can make this step backwards and say, okay, I start from the beginning, or I do it different, or I realize how to do it different. Maybe you just realize why it's not working. If you win, and if you always win, you don't care about why I did this gold medal, or what was the good thing I've made such a kind of preparation. Did I something different? No, you don't care about it because you won. And then it gets boring, really. Sometimes you win and what's the next step? Maybe world champion or Olympic champion. Okay, yeah, it's fine. But you don't think about your training partners, your sparrings. Maybe they do the same and they don't have the same results. But I guess it's very interesting if I'm now able to look in my last years how I see myself and how I see me changing.
Is there an example of maybe one time that you failed or that you lost or that you directly made a change out of that you can give us?
Yeah, there are different perspectives, but what's a very good example is my first Olympic Games in Beijing. After this loss in the first round against the North Korean, whereas I've never ever really thought about failing, about losing. I was so prepared. I knew I beat her. I will take this medal, and the first round I will beat this North Korean. When I lost, I was somewhere. I don't know where, but I couldn't speak to somebody. They took my bottom out of this reach. I was on another planet. I couldn't realize what's happening. And this took me days. Really, I was locked in my room, and yes, my training partner and my coach, they spoke to me, and it took really days to realize what's going on here. I mean, there are so many people who lose in the first round or who lose in the Olympic Games, but why are you not prepared to take this as normal? And I guess after this, weeks after this, I had this progress to realize, okay, there are chances out of it. You can take this chance, this experience, to be a better judo fighter, a better person, a better teammate, whatever, to step forward and motivate not only yourself, but also your team. And if you do this in a way which makes sense for yourself, then something bigger will happen. That's one of these small chances in life where you really change something in your mind.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds like it had such an amazing impact on you, because, you know, not many people can say that they had the opportunity to learn from an Olympic Games. You know, it's like the top 0.01% that ever get the opportunity to go to the Olympics. And so thank you for sharing that, because that is such a difficult process to walk through, and to be able to hear that from you and how you've actually turn that around to grow from it is really incredible. And I guess on the other side of things, can you remember if there have been any fights that you've had that are your favorite, or any wins that you really stand out as highlights for you?
Yes, one fight. It's not a fight from world championships, not the fight during Olympic Games or even a major tournament. Is the fight against Kaori Matsumoto, the Olympic champion, 57 kilograms, during a Masters competition. She was already Olympic champion, and we trained a lot in her university in Taekyu, but she somehow was a mastermind of tactics, of being not only aggressive, being prepared for each kind of her opponents, even if it's a strong one, a technical one, a technician, a very high precise technician. And I knew she knows my judo very well. But I was trying to prepare my mind for this fight, and I was like trying to do something different than in other fights, which sometimes is not very good, because if you change your mindset or you change your tactics, you will lose. But somehow I was like trying to do something in this fight which like surprised her. So I was using more Ashiwaza, even she's very strong in Ashiwaza. And suddenly there was this technique, like I caught her with Koichi, and she couldn't like get up till the end of the fight, and I won the fight. So I was really surprised about winning against the Olympic champion in such way, which I've never expected before. That's for the competitions where I don't really know if somebody remembers, but myself is remembering very well.
Yes. Look, I think everyone would remember if they beat the Olympic champion. I think that's so amazing. So it was almost, you're saying, an instinctive thing, that the technique that you don't even usually do just popped up and you just reacted with that Koichi.
Somehow, yes. But more, I would describe it like she's so high level technician judo fighter. She's not like doing everything with power. She can adjust, and that's very difficult because she's moving all the time in all directions. And I knew she's a specialist in Newaza, which I'm also, but if we fight on Newaza, it can take us 10 or 15 minutes till something happens. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes boring to watch, but yeah, it's like very exhausting.
And yeah, I knew in Newaza, sure,
chances are like 50-50. So during this fight was not much in Newaza. We were fighting in Tachiwaza, and it was all about Ashiwaza and moving, and yeah,
it worked.
Nice, it worked.
Yeah. It worked great. That's an awesome highlight. And if that were me, I would be telling everybody every single day that story.
Somebody asks you about the fight which you will never forget. Usually I have many moments which I will never forget. If I throw somebody Ippon and it's like a big Uchimata, or I hold somebody on the ground and it's Ippon, okay, I remember, sure. I really remember very well, and everybody can watch it on the video, and my coach will tell me years afterwards, oh, what an impressive Ippon for the European Championships in 2008. I remember this very good thing. Yeah, I remember, but this fight is something like I will not forget because of the mindset, the preparation, and how the fight went. That's really, really nice. Usually I don't watch so many videos from last competitions, just if I prepare for someone, mm-hmm, during my study with the coach for a competition. But I don't watch a video because I wanted to know my throw or my technique in the year 2008. No, because judo is changing each day. It's, yeah, changing all the time. And if you watch your opponent from 5 years before, now she is a different person. She's a different athlete. She has different techniques. She moves different. She has different power. So I don't watch too many videos from myself. Maybe from Maruyama or something. I watch videos. Yes.
Yeah. So what's that process like to prepare for a fight?
Usually just if I don't know before, if she's right or left, and then the major techniques, like if she's doing Seonagi or Uchimata, or if she's throwing both sides, if she's doing some counter techniques when I enter my technique, and usually what's happening about transition. I love to do really strong transitioning, but if I feel weak and the person or the opponent is very strong in doing her own transition, then I'm not so confident. I lose a lot of time, some seconds to be really fast to do the same. So I have to watch this.
That's a really good point. I've never thought about that before. So I sort of wanted to ask about your mountain climbing and your bike riding. And so that we're going to change course a little bit. You know, you've mentioned before that you go on really long bike rides and you climb mountains during your rest days. If you could have a perfect day where you can climb or run or whatever for as long as you want, what is that? How long would you do that for?
Oh, that's a very difficult question because it's depending on the mountain itself, which, how big is the mountain or the way, or especially you have to watch the weather, if it's winter or summer. Here in summer, we get some thunderstorms in the afternoon, so we have to start pretty early, maybe 4 or 5 o'clock. But when I do this during summer right now, I start probably at 5 and be back for lunch. It's pretty awesome to give everything during a big climb, which is very technical. But if the weather is not perfect and it's rainy, you have to be careful and take out a little speed. So you take it easy. You just enjoy the day, the mountains around. And that's for me a perfect day. If you come back and you sit down with your family or your friends having some Austrian dishes and enjoying that you have burnt like 6 or 7 hours straight, a lot of calories, so you can enjoy afterwards the dishes.
That's a very long endurance type thing. But do you think building that dimension of fitness helps the judo? Can you see that?
I can see it definitely, because you have a better regeneration process. Your stamina is really good. You have a very low pulse rate. That means you get back your shape in a faster way. So after a long day, you sleep very well. And in the morning, you're fit and back again. Nothing wow. hurts. It feels sore if you do it regularly. If you just like it once a week or once a month, you always feel sore. Your muscles are burning. You feel tired and you think, oh my God, I shouldn't have done like 10 hours straight. No, if you do it regularly, it gets natural. You get in a good shape.
When you say regular, for me, once a month is regular to do something like that, because I never do that. When you say regular, what does that mean for you?
Yeah, it depends on the season. But right now I call it the COVID season. Mm-hmm. And it started in March. Mm-hmm. And from March till now, we have now August. I nearly did conditioning each day. So there are days with 2 or 3 hours. And there are days where I do no judo or no gym training, where I sit on the bike like 8 or 9 hours just to enjoy it.
Wow.
It's like kind of training for, I don't know, climbers or marathon runners. But for me, it's now a kind of lifestyle to support my Sherpa families, my judo club in the Everest region in Nepal. Because I have this mindset to get so many meters in altitude as I can get till this corona season is over. Mm-hmm. And somehow I do something for my stamina. And sure, now it's really difficult to adjust, but we already started to do judo and we started to do strong weight training. So I have to do a little lower conditioning programs. But right now I have more than 200,000 meters in altitude. So that means it's an average of 10,000 meters in altitude per week.
Oh, that's incredible. And so when you're doing that, like when you're, you know, on a 7-10 hour ride or a climb, what are you thinking about? Are you listening to music or do you think about philosophy? Or
in the mountains, usually I don't hear music because you have to be aware where you am, how the weather changes, how the terrain not feels but moves somehow. There is glacier, there is snow, there is rocks, there is if you hear music, you're not in this area. I can hear music when I just go out for a run or I go for a straight bike ride. Then sometimes I hear music. But if I'm there out there for 4 or 5 hours, usually I don't listen to something. I just let the mind go. Whatever comes. I'm thinking sometimes about climbing some difficult mountains or going into the Himalayas, trying to find my way in my head. And suddenly there is always something like you have to be in this moment. So during your climb or your ride, there are many different things which just come up in the moment. So you have to be there in this moment. Otherwise you crash or you fall or you injure yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously your love for climbing mountains, that has led you to some other mountains around the world and has brought a strong connection for you with Nepal. So can you tell me, when was the first time you went to Nepal?
The very first time was 2005, when I just wanted to experience the Himalaya, when I wanted to do some trekking, maybe up to 6,000 meter, nothing higher, just to know how it feels to be in high altitude, how the body reacts. And this was also in the Khumbu Everest region, so I had the chance to walk with some friends to learn about the culture of the Nepalese and to know how they live, how they cook, how they enjoy their things, sharing with some tourists. I got from the first moment into it. I was so in awe with the mountains there, but also about the deep respect and humble persons there. And when I came back, I wanted to support them.
Yeah, for sure. So it sounds like you actually developed quite a deep connection with the people there. What was it like first meeting them?
The first meeting was not with Judo people. It was with some Sherpas who also worked in Austria. We have there a program in Austria which helps Sherpas coming to Austria, and they get education to build up their own business, how to cook, how to serve to people, how to keep their own lodges in Nepal in a good condition, to be like, to know how to use medicaments for European people or for Western people. They learn a lot here during the main season in Austria, and then they go back and open their lodges. That's how it started. I asked then in Kathmandu if there is some Judo, and I was very fast into it, to help in some orphanages where they had projects, people helping the kids doing Judo during their school education. And then somehow, after a couple of times bringing some equipment there, I met the one Sherpa who had this Monju school in about 2,800 meters. And his dream was like building a Judo place for the mountain people, not in Kathmandu, where already there was some projects supported by the IGF and Judo for Peace. He wanted to build up Judo in the altitude. And I was so blown away by his visions, because he didn't have so much support by then. He just had some geese and maybe some old tatamis. But tourists are walking through this village very often. So also there are many Japanese going through, and they are very surprised when they see a Judo place in a school, in a remote village somewhere in the Himalayas. So I was thinking about it, and maybe we can build up a bigger project to support this school and bring the Judo even higher. Last year, this project started to be really serious, and right now it's working to get some support also from Japan to bring some tatamis from Tokai University to Kathmandu, and from Kathmandu per airplane to Lukla, where they have to carry, or maybe if we have collected enough money, we can bring it per helicopter to this Sir Edmund Hillary School in Kumchung, which is at nearly 4,000 meter. So this school is the secondary school. The primary school was Monju school. And when the school kids finish their education there, they also have to finish Judo. This was the main thing which brought it into my mind, because when they have to finish Judo, they are very sad and didn't want to go up to the next school in Kumchung, which is on 4,000 meter. They have to stop Judo. So now it's a pretty big project to get the kids there, together with the kids at Kumchung school, a proper place for a dojo and maybe a long-term coach to get Judo into Kumchung school there.
Yeah, wow. And so that we can get a little bit of context and understanding, what does the dojo look like there at 4,000 meters altitude? Is it big? Is it small? What do they have?
Community hall. The Manju school have like a 30 tatamis. It's pretty small, like six meters long and 4 meters wide. But at Kumchung school, we have the possibility to get there 50 tatamis. So 50 tatamis means like it's a pretty good place for a whole class, maybe 20 kids doing Judo there in the same time. So no, nobody has to sit outside and wait till Judo kids are ready, so they all should do Judo together in a good place.
One thing that intrigues me is, you know, these Nepalese people, I guess naturally they live on a mountain, they must be physically strong, they must have amazing aerobic capacity. How does that translate to their Judo? What does their Judo style look like?
That's a very interesting question, but everybody is thinking about being really strong, tough, to get good stamina there. That's maybe, I would say, somehow it's right, but on the other side, the kids there are not very healthy. They eat not enough. They have like maybe 2 dishes of rice a day, and they have a lack of vitamins, they have a lack of healthy food, and so they are very often sick. I mean, they cough a lot, they have like sniffing all the time, and they are very thin, not a lot of muscles. It's very difficult to build up muscles in this altitude because you burn so much calories, you burn so much energy. If you would like to build up muscles, you could do like 100,000 push-ups, but you will not build up muscles because the nutrition is not right there. That's a very difficult thing to, what's the challenge for myself, to get them enough nutrition on the one side and to get like a healthy lifestyle on the other side. We have to be careful about the medical treatment there. There is Kunde Hospital, which is the biggest medical center in this area. It's mainly for the tourists. Mainly during the tourist season, you can go there and you get treatment for your altitude sickness. But I want like to get some connection with the school, that also the school kids which are training Judo then get enough and good medical treatment to get the best medicines for a good training. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. They could train each day, but if the floor, the bottom is always like -5 degrees, they will not survive very long there because they get sick all the time. Last time when I've been there, they were training in their winter holidays in the Montreux school on a floor without heating in this room. So outside was like 2 meters of snow, the same temperature than inside. And they wore like big jackets under their knees. But, you know, you don't do Judo with socks. So they had no socks. Wow. And I was like freezing and shivering. And I said, how do they do this each day, Kazi? Kazi is the name of the coach, the shepherd. And he said, oh, Sabrina, you know, it's really no problem. We just warm up 10 minutes longer.
Wow.
So brainwashed, because he said, really, like, okay, the situation is no problem. It doesn't matter what's the temperature or how difficult and rough the conditions are. We just warm up 10 minutes longer. Then we are warm enough to do Judo. So wow. It's really, it was mind-blowing when he told this, because I was like, I mean, I know about how difficult it is if you have frozen toes on a high mountain and you cannot like go to the next doctor to get the good treatment to warm them up. So I know what can happen if you're sick up there, if you don't get like medical treatment. But they don't want to have it for real. They just go for it and they have so much fun and commitment to train Judo there. It made my mind richer.
Yeah, for sure. That's so resilient. Can't believe that. And so, like, I guess all that nutritional and health side of things is a big challenge. But what else is challenging about building a club on the, you know, on the side of a mountain?
The other thing is, like, you have to be careful because also the Nepal Judo Federation wants to work together with us somehow. But the main focus is Kathmandu. So the main city of the whole country is Kathmandu, where there are thousands of people in need. There are orphanages, there are projects in all different ways, but all the money usually which is given by funding, by supporting some organizations, flows into Kathmandu. All the political things behind it is mainly in Kathmandu. So get these things out of the main capital, to get it to remote places, to places where people are really in need of something, is difficult. You have to speak with a lot of people. You have to have a good network of local people. Even if I know many people now, I always like it more if I'm there and speaking to this person, giving this person the money or the equipment which they need, then I know, okay, this is the right way. He will do the right thing.
You know, these kids obviously get a lot of joy out of training judo there. So from what you've been able to see, how has having a judo club helped the community?
I would say it opens their mind immediately. I mean, you could do any kind of sport there and they are happy. You know, if you play table tennis or badminton or, yeah, it's not so easy in these places to play ball games because the ball sometimes is just on the mountain. But
you never see it again.
But judo, and full of our values, this mindset makes it so perfect because people there are religious, respectful. They have these values already in their mind. They are somehow connected with all different parts of the world because there are tourists coming. They want to speak English. They learn different languages because they see like Japanese people climbing. They see people from America or Australia going through, and they have this feeling of they want to connect with the world somehow, but they are not able to. They just, the parents tell them, okay, you're gonna be a cook and cook for the tourists, or you're gonna be a porter and you carry the things for the tourists up to Everest base camp. But with judo, they have the chance to go to different places, to go to Kathmandu, to see other judokas, to see other possibilities, to maybe if they get strong, they go to Bhutan, to India, to join some competitions. They will see the world and they speak to their community and say, okay, with sport or with judo, I have the chance to get out of my country, to experience something new, to get a good education, which is the most valuable thing there. And then, it makes sense for myself.
Wow. That's so incredible, because I guess I live in a first world country, so I often overlook how valuable judo is as a passport to international sort of opportunities and like a bridge to greater learning opportunities that that opens up for them. And so, you know, you're doing a little bit of fundraising for them, is that right?
Right now I started this GoFundMe project, which is called Everest Judo Club. And yeah, all my Japanese friends and many Austrians and friends all over the world now support it. And we're just collecting money to be able to get all the equipment there and then support them in different ways, not only in the education, also the best medical treatment. If it's possible, good nutrition would be really, really good.
Yes.
But it has to be sustainable, and we have to have like a long-term coach there. So that's what we are working in the next year on it. And yeah, it's a long way to go, but I love this challenge.
So one of the things that's challenging, especially at the moment, is I am assuming that a lot of the income stream during the pandemic would have slowed down. Is that right?
It's completely right. So you have these two seasons, the spring season and the autumn season, and all the Sherpas are relying on just a few weeks a year when the tourists come to their country and they pay money. So springtime is March, April, May, where they climb Everest or other 8,000 meter peaks. And the next season is now coming in September, October, but it's not sure if it will happen or not, because they had a very strict lockdown. Everybody was like inside their houses in Kathmandu. Nobody could go out. In the mountains, in the Khumbu region right now, it's a good thing because people can grow in their garden something to eat. But you don't have the possibility to get some more rice if there is strict lockdown. Every border is controlled and they don't get rice from India, which is needed. and they don't get something from China. But yeah, that's a really difficult thing right now for them. They don't have any income.
On a really practical level, what are some of the things that we can do to help them?
So I have set up this GoFundMe project to have like a sum of money which can overlook what's happening with it and how they use it. But now I just collect money and we will see how we can use this money best and not waste it for sending something somewhere which maybe customs or taxes are taking.
That's an amazing goal and an amazing purpose. And, you know, I personally am so inspired just hearing you talk about it. So, yeah, thank you so much for your time. It's been amazing talking to you.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
Listeners, if you want to help Nepal and the Everest Judo Club, you know, you've heard how much joy it brings to the kids over there, how much it helps them on a really practical level as well, then head over to the Everest Judo Club's GoFundMe page. I will put that in the link below.
Until next time, this is Melissa Budiato signing off.